We're ready when you are.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Judge, and may it please the court, I'm Pat Callishaw. Work with the law firm of Jackson Walker in Dallas, and it's my privilege and responsibility this morning to represent the appellant, Randall Glenn Goodale. This is a case that was tried to the bench. It was tried to Judge Rodriguez. Many things were not disputed in this case. Mr. Goodale did not dispute that he committed a crime when he used a stolen checkbook to pass several checks at a rural convenience store named the Lavernia One Stop in South Texas outside San Antonio. And he used those checks to obtain about $485 worth of goods, cigarettes, food, gasoline, and some cash over a three-day period in July of 2009. He did dispute, and we dispute here again this morning, that this constituted federal bank fraud. There was no scheme or artifice to defraud a federally insured financial institution here. There was an attempt to take some stolen checks and over a quick period of time pass a few of them at an out-of-town convenience store. To set the more precise issue...
Well, at that point, I wanted to ask you a couple of procedural questions, and I want to ask you about your understanding of Section 1344 of the bank fraud statute. As I understand it, not only did Mr. Goodale not testify at the bench trial, but he did not present any evidence?
He did not present any evidence. There were two witnesses at the trial, I believe, Mr. Rumpel, the person whose checks were stolen, and the Wells Fargo bank representative.
Ms. Valdez.
Correct.
And he did not move for judgment of acquittal at trial.
I don't recall, Your Honor.
Well, I know you didn't try the case. The federal public defender did, but you ought to know the record. But I don't see any evidence in the docket that he moved for judgment of acquittal.
I believe that's correct. I believe at the end of the evidence they argued the issues to Judge Rodriguez.
And I understand that we don't require a judgment of acquittal in a bench trial to preserve a sufficiency challenge such as you're making here to give the normal standard of review to the court's ruling. Now, you mentioned that the evidence failed to show he had an intent to defraud. Is it your understanding that there are two different offenses under the bank fraud statute? One is intent to defraud, and the other is to deprive a bank or a financial institution of money. So you can be liable under one or the other.
The second subset of 1344, as I understand it, is the provision that requires, or the elements are obtaining monies or other things from the property of the insured institution by false representations, pretenses, et cetera. It's my understanding that Judge Rodriguez really made his decision with respect to and the findings of fact and conclusions of law that he made, notwithstanding the objections that we have, the quarrels that we have with him, that he was making findings under subsection 1 in terms of intent to defraud.
But as I read your brief, you seem to be contending there's only liability if part subsection 2 was satisfied, risk of loss. That's where I'm a little lost here as to what exactly you're claiming and what exactly the district judge ruled.
Let me see if I can help, and we may have candidly struggled some with it as we developed the argument, but Your Honor, as the Judge Rodriguez below, the government here, and the court's decision in Morganfield state as a requirement for a 1344 conviction that the government must demonstrate at least an actual or potential risk of loss to the federally insured financial institution. And that is the means by which, in this case, Judge Riguez did find Mr. Goodell had the requisite intent. He found that because he read the testimony as establishing a risk of loss, that the requisite intent was present, and that's how he got to the conviction. And so that's the point of our argument that...
But the statute itself says, whoever knowingly executes or attempts to execute a scheme or artifice, one, to defraud a financial institution, SIMI, or two, to obtain any of the monies, funds, shall be fined not less than. So you can be liable under 1344 under either intent to defraud or executing a scheme to obtain any of the monies. And again, your brief seems to just subsume all of this into having to prove risk of loss, and you're saying you're just relying on case law.
I'm relying on the Morganfield case as well as the fact that that's how Judge Rodriguez got to his conclusion that there was intent in this particular case.
Did the indictment
because of the risk
did
of
the
loss.
Indictment allege risk of loss? I had the same interest in, as I was looking at the case separately from Judge Barksdale. I had the same. You look at 1344, no subsection talks about risk of loss, but then our pattern instructions do list it as an element. But here there was no jury, there was no jury instruction, no jury charges. Did the indictment, I should have looked at it. Does it refer to risk of loss?
It refers to the requirement of intent.
Right. So you're saying risk of loss is proving intent. But the scienter in the statute is knowingly. Then subsection 1 is to defraud, or subsection 2 would be obtain money through false pretenses. And you've just said you think that the theory that was relied on to find a conviction was the first or the second?
The theory that...
The risk of loss does seem to be a strange thing that's come into the law. And our pattern instructions say it goes back to a McCauley case. But even if there is that element, and it didn't go to jury, and there wasn't a Rule 29, so I agree with Judge Barksdale, it's pretty hard for us to be looking at this in an advisory capacity. But here, wouldn't it be a fair inference that he intended to cause a risk of loss if the Wells Fargo witness says the bank was at risk, similar to Morganfield, because they might have honored the check, and he, the defendant, his attorney admits, didn't know it wasn't a valid account?
And let me just answer a little bit on the first part of your question, and then I'll come to the second. The first part, in terms of Judge Rodriguez's observation, and it's consistent with my reading of Morganfield, that the Fifth Circuit has made it clear that the government need prove that a substantial risk of loss was there. He doesn't always use the word substantial, and I don't think the word substantial is imperative, but Morganfield at least recites this as an element of a 1344 proof.
The Wells Fargo witness said there was a risk.
The Wells Fargo witness is really in, and I would simply ask, and I think the best thing I can do is ask the court to read her testimony in its entirety, as you may well already have. Ms. Valdez works for Wells Fargo. When she was first asked about how would as I may not have stated yet, the checking account in question here, unlike Morganfield and a lot of other cases, had been closed 8 months, 10 months before these checks were presented. And Ms. Valdez was asked, is there a potential risk, how would there be a potential risk of loss to the bank with a closed account? How would that work? That was the prosecutor's question. And she answered, I don't know. I don't know how that would happen. With a closed account, it would have to be something unusual. The prosecutor then asks her, well, what about human error? She asks, well, I guess human error is always a possibility. What about computer error? Well, computers can always go wrong. She's later asked to clarify, when you're talking about human error, computer error, as you were, are you talking about the kind of error that's present whenever the bank processes a check, even a good check? And she answers yes, explaining that, for example, on a good check, the bank may process the wrong amount as a result of human error or computer error. She's further asked, is there anything about what Mr. Goodale did to these checks? For example, did he do something to the bank and the account identifying numbers or the magnetic imprint on the check? Was there any alteration or any damage to the check? Did he do anything to aggravate that risk that's always present when the bank processes a check? No, I don't see anything of that sort. So that's her testimony, and if that testimony is sufficient to establish risk of loss and provide the predicate, the sole predicate, for an inference of intent to commit bank fraud, that risk is present by her testimony every time a good check, certainly every time an insufficient funds check is presented anywhere. And that reading really would take intent in that fashion out of the statute and create a national hot check law, which my understanding is not what 1344 is intended to be. This is not like Morgan Field, where somebody thought of creating some artificial businesses, opening bank accounts, trying to run money then through those bank accounts and get it out at merchants, and where there were a host of direct interactions and misrepresentations to a bank before the before any checks were even passed, and the bank was clearly the target.
Well, Morgan Field was a check kiting scheme, so it was more than one. But I when I reread the decision, I read it to be as to just the claim that there wouldn't be a risk of loss. It's perfectly possible, for whatever reason, a bank seeing its own check might issue funds on it, even if there weren't enough funds. Could just be computer error. Could just be human error. Check comes in, they pay on it. Later, they realize there weren't enough funds. That's what a check kite is. So the Fifth Circuit, our discussion of that almost mirrored what the Wells Fargo person said.
Your Honor, Morgan Field didn't deal with accounts that had been closed before for months, before any of the checks were processed.
But Goodale's attorney said he didn't know that it was a closed check, closed account.
But in terms of the proof of the potential risk of loss, what Ms. Valdez testified was that with the closed account, there was simply no way to imagine a risk of a loss to the bank other than in the same fashion that the bank always faces, even when it's processing a good check. And that's really the fundamental point of our argument, that it reads the intent requirement out of the statute to that degree.
Along the line of what, if anything, Goodell knew about the status of the checking account, it was my understanding, as Judge Higginson has said, that his counsel admitted at trial that the defendant was unaware that the account had been closed. Yet in your reply brief at page 5, note 4, you seem to dispute that. And you say, there was no evidence whatsoever to support the district court statement that Goodell was unaware of whether the checking account was closed, not closed, etc. So what's in the record? Did he admit he did not know the account was closed, or is your brief correct?
You were asking about the record earlier. After the two witnesses had testified and Ms. Valdez had been excused, the lawyers then presented argument on the same issues we're talking about today to Judge Rodriguez. And during that argument, there is a colloquy in which the judge poses that question, and I think counsel, the public defender, says correct. There was no testimony from any witness on that issue, and while it is not evidence, and I tried to make that clear in my note, Mr. Goodale raised this issue at his sentencing and expressed expressed that he had had a very strong sense that these checks were no good. The fact that he presented all the checks to a single rural convenience store over a three-day period, which takes us into the weekend, not at a series of places, is consistent with understanding that you've got a set of checks that may do you some good at a place where no one is going to have check verification and there's going to be no communication to the bank. That is, that he understood.
Is it your position that counsel's saying, admitting to the judge that Goodell was unaware the account was closed? Is it your position we can't rely on that? Counsel's answering the judge at a very brief bench trial where they could have reconvened the trial?
Well, Your Honor, it was during argument, but to me the more important point is that as we read Morganfield.
No, answer my question. Can we take that as an admission just as these other stipulated facts or not? What's your position?
I believe you can take the attorney's statement as an admission.
Thank you.
But Mr. Goodale's awareness or lack of awareness, and again, his conduct is to the contrary, the requirement of proof of loss that is in the case law remains an element, and it remains the way in which Judge Rodriguez got to his finding.
So it's your position the word defraud in subpart one of the statute includes risk of loss. Under the elements of fraud, there's got to be injury. Is that your position, that we read that into the word to defraud?
It is my position that under Morganfield and other statements, this court, as followed by Judge Rodriguez, has made proof of loss, proof of risk of loss, not proof of loss. There was no contention that the bank had to lose money. It had to be put at some real risk of loss in order for this to be a scheme to defraud a federal financial institution, not an attempt to get some value from stolen property. And again, it's never been Mr. Goodale's contention that he did not commit a crime in this instance, but the crime he committed was not federal bank fraud.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Colasaw. You reserved rebuttal time. Mr. Gay, you're up.
Good morning. May it please the Court. In preparation for this oral argument, I spent some time talking with one of our bank fraud experts, and this whole issue of risk of loss came up, and it was very illuminating. And what's interesting about Section 1, and if you look at our indictment, we allege both theories. We allege 1 and 2. We list the scheme, artifice to defraud, and then the second sentence, and to obtain monies, the provisions of Section 2. What's interesting about the scheme or artifice to defraud is that basically in this case, it's an attempt. This is an inchoate offense. And in every case where you have an attempt, there is, by logical definition, no risk of loss because it's an attempt. It was an act that was never completed, so the bank could not have ever paid. And so under 1, I think, Judge Barksdale, your inquiry into this and your observation that the pattern which I've looked at has sort of brought into this risk of loss language is clear. Now, the district
risk
court.
Risk of loss language under Part 1 to defraud?
Under Part 2,
right,
Your Honor.
But the pattern, go ahead.
Well,
the pattern instructions describe four elements or five elements for both. He didn't refer to Thomas in argument, but the Third Circuit says, you know, if we just allow one to stand alone, it's way too broad. It just requires intent to deceive, not a direct target.
Mm-hmm.
And the courts do seem very worried that I think a version of his argument would allow a bad check to be a 1344 felony because you don't have intent. You don't know your account doesn't have enough money, but you issue the check. It goes to the bank. They might make a mistake and issue funds on it, and then because they were at risk of loss, the argument would be that you can infer from that that there was intent to deceive, subsection 1, and anybody who ever issues a check where they don't have enough money has just committed to 1344.
And I believe you're saying that where the endorsement is not forged, actually.
Yeah, where it's not forged. Exactly. That's the worry of these courts that are trying to blur the two subsections together. Am I right?
I believe that's correct. Yeah. My analysis is that this is a largely open question, mm-hmm. and that the courts have not sought to pin this down. I did bring the pattern jury for this jury instruction, and it's interesting. For the note specifically says for a prosecution under 1344.1, modify the language in the first paragraph to track the statute. Then they cite to a case called Harvard. But it does appear that the Fifth Circuit has sort of at least as to two definitely required this risk of loss analysis. And on one, I think it is less than clear whether it's really there or not is, I guess, all I can say at this point. Hmm. However, I think where we end up is that we're trying to use this risk of loss to vitiate the scienter requirement of knowingly, which is just contrary to every court's opinion that has looked at this. Every court that has, and this is not an unusual case, many, many cases have charged fraudulent check submissions as bank fraud. And the reason why is because the natural consequence of placing that check into the stream of commerce is that the bank is going to receive it. Every time a bank makes a mistake, it's human or computer error. There's a reason why it says risk of loss. There's no requirement there be an actual loss.
But in the first part of the, excuse me, of the section, of the indictment, I mean, it's alleging a scheme.
That's correct.
Or an artifice to the fraud. And ordinarily, in any kind of pleading, if you will, if we talk about fraud almost axiomatically. We're talking about pleading, proving with particularity, not with this sort of inchoate nature. I mean, fraud almost inherently, whether in Louisiana or whatever, criminal statute denotes some particularity about it, not a more in court, Kuwait, you know, sort of around here. And so, I mean, the government chose to charge, as it frequently does in these kind of cases. They charged the defendant with three different counts. They got him dead to rights on one, maybe to induce a plea on the other, whatever. I'm not chastising the government's power to charge, but it's not unusual that we get an indictment where it's charged, count one, count two, count three. And like, he doesn't contest the last charge, I think, the theft piece of it, there's not a dispute. Well, my point is that under the Section 1, it seemed to denote more particularity with respect to what you're saying is an element than what you're relying on. I mean, you seem to be wanting to import an element into it that doesn't seem to be there. So,
every case that has looked
But I guess my real question is a question Judge Barstow asked earlier to counsel. What did Judge Rodriguez actually find as relates to what the government charged?
Judge Rodriguez specifically says, the way I interpret this is that it is being charged under 18 U.S.C. 1344-2.
What page of it is
that? That is at page 38 of the bench trial transcript, at the top of the page.
Okay, I don't think we have that in our record excerpts. All right.
And so he does specifically do his analysis under 2, which is, and admittedly, everybody had up to that point somewhat framed the argument under this long line of cases that, and Morganfield speaks to them, that essentially say, and the government I think was correct, that when you knowingly present yourself as the authorized signer, but when you're not, and you submit that check, and there's no dispute, I don't think anybody's challenging that you can submit to a third party, that ultimately, that as a matter of law, is a scheme or artifice to defraud. That act of knowingly forging a signature on a check that you know is not yours, which is not disputed in this case, is a scheme or artifice to defraud. In this case, it's essentially an attempt.
And presenting false ID, I suppose he had to do that.
He did, Your Honor. And he assumed the identity, and he was convicted of identity theft as well,
right,
of the true account holder.
But I'm saying, and again, we don't have the complete transcript, and we don't have the stipulations, but I assume that part of the identity fraud is not only that he stole the man's driver's license and other identity, but I assume that part of 1344 proof was is that when he presented the check, as is often the case now, he had to show some identification.
And they wrote down the driver's license number on the check, and absolutely that's what happened. The other interesting thing that came up about why we have, as a matter of policy, this idea that if you fraudulently endorse a check and submit it into the stream of commerce is that many banks, and in this case, the bank was not, the check was not originally submitted directly to Wells Fargo. It was submitted to the Lavergne One Stops Bank, and then it goes to a clearinghouse, and they all match up. And there's some discussion of that in the record, how all that works. But what happens is, as a practical matter, the reason why, as a matter of policy, we do this is because the receiving bank is often not the ultimate bank responsible for the check. It could be. But almost all banks offer provisional credit to their customers who have accounts on checks before they know whether that check could clear. They have relationships. The idea that they're at risk extends even beyond, and some of the cases talk about loss of reputation, a lot of different things that go into this idea of loss. And what we have here is, I think, a very the reason why it is essentially, as I would say, almost as a matter of law, evidence of a scheme or artifice to defraud, is because that the bank is inherently at risk any time an instrument is placed.
So is that a limiting principle you're articulating or a broadening concept? In other words, again, the worry would be the logic that's being asserted here could mean one check submitted when unknowingly there weren't enough funds. What element wouldn't be met in that case?
That it has to be a fraudulent endorsement. There is no doubt that this is not a hot check, that we're arguing that there's any kind of national hot check case, where if you just happen to overdraw your account, whether intentionally or negligently, that you would be guilty of bank
fraud. That's because you wouldn't have the intent
That's
to
correct.
Defraud.
Because but, it was not a fraudulent endorsement.
A fraud, okay.
In other words, if it is a legitimate check, and there are lots of cases which actually say we do not find bank fraud, where the endorsement is proper.
Well, that's the Thomas case, yeah, to a certain extent.
And several Taylor, there's several that flow, I believe, from that same line of reasoning. And that is that if the check is drawn on a proper account with a proper signature, in one of the fact patterns, there was...
Well, make it closer to this case then. Let's say he walks into the same store, but he's scribbled on a piece of paper, this is a Wells Fargo check. So there clearly is no account at all, but the merchant might possibly submit it to the Wells Fargo bank, and there could be just computer error.
If it is not a legitimate instrument.
Okay, but then it wouldn't be, correct?
Right,
but see, that's sort of their argument, which is this was a closed account, so no instrument could have been legitimate.
Actually, that, whether it's closed or not closed, is completely, I think, irrelevant ultimately to the question, because it is a valid instrument of the bank, and until such time as it's presented, and she does testify, that in every case where the bank makes a mistake, it's because of computer or human error. It's a mistake by nature. And that is part of why it's listed as a risk, not an absolute requirement of loss. It's simply a risk. And then there is a risk. And in this case, I think it's pretty clear that someone who steals a checkbook and then uses those checks has no idea whether the account has $1 million or $1, or whether it's closed. This has to do with his intent when negotiates that instrument.
Well, and it may be too nuanced and hypothetical, but when you say, oh, it never would apply if the instrument being used weren't legitimate, I think their simple argument is, by virtue of being closed, let's say it was closed for 20 years, then it wouldn't be a legitimate instrument, and therefore there was never a risk of loss. That's their argument, I think.
I think you gave the example of a slip of paper, and I think that's different than a check with routing numbers to a specific bank.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that is a very distinguishing feature, that this is something quite different than just a slip of paper. And what's interesting is in Morganfield, this court has an opinion in Church, and in that case, the court observed, and I think it was pretty interesting, talking about how it says from Church, this is quoted in footnote 51 of Morganfield, indeed, in United States versus Church, this court upheld an attempt bank fraud conviction where the defendant's plan, quote, was no more likely to succeed than a request that the bank exchange monopoly money for its face value in U.S. currency, unquote. And so the case law is clear that how remote the scheme is or how unlikely it is that the bank is going to pay is not the focus of the inquiry. The focus of the inquiry is, and whoever knowingly executes a scheme or attempts or artifice to defraud. And so every case that has looked at this fact pattern from the Second Circuit and the Fourth Circuit has held this is bank fraud. And this case is no different than any of those cases.
Ms. Valdez's testimony is in the record excerpts, and I don't recall from my reading it whether she was asked directly, if an account is closed and a check is presented against it, is there an increased risk of error?
She said that in absent a human or computer error, the bank would never pay on a closed account. That was her testimony. And that's similar to if they don't look at the signature card. Once again, a bank has an obligation to verify the customer's signature card upon presentment, that the signature is valid. And in every one of those cases, either through negligence or just mistake, that's exactly how an error occurs. There, in the normal processing of events.
But I don't believe she testified about signature cards.
She did not mention. I'm just logically extending here. But she does say that only through error. And whether it's an error or whether all mistakes by nature are error, it would seem to me, just looking at it logically. The fact that she said that it's remote doesn't mean that it's not a risk. And that's what this court has observed. And Morganfield, they specifically referenced the Church decision that talks about that. In sum, I think this is not an unusual case. I think this is a...
Maybe it's unusual from the fact that the federal government's suing over $500.
I had anticipated there might be an observation. I do not understand exactly the decisions why. I assume that this case was brought for a variety of reasons that weren't disclosed in the record, and I'm not here to speculate about those.
Does the record disclose whether any state charges were brought on the car break-in or anything?
I don't know, Your Honor. But at the end of the day, the more narrow question is whether under 1344, the presentment of a forged check to a bank can constitute bank fraud, and I believe that the cases unanimously say that it can. If there are no further questions, I'll yield back my time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gay. Mr. Collishaw, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ms. Valdez was asked when the prosecutor was talking to her about how human error might create a problem with a check on a closed account. She was asked, what would happen if the coding on the check is destroyed or damaged? And the teller of the system wouldn't know what to do with it, she says. And is that an example of a situation where Wells Fargo might pay on a closed account? Possibly. And then that's what then she was later asked to clarify. Well, you've looked at the checks in this case. Was that done on any of the checks here? And the answer was no, it was not. And I think what we've just heard is that the risk that's associated with passing a check on a closed account is the same risk of human mistake or computer mistake that puts the bank at risk of loss whenever any of us presents a perfectly good check to the bank. And again, unless the requirement for purposes of at least subsection 2 of the statute of proof of risk of loss is to be rendered meaningless or simply taken back out of the statute, then if it's satisfied here, it's always going to be satisfied. This is an unusual case, and there was a lot of discussion in argument just now about different kinds of risks of loss to intermediary banks, different sorts of scenarios, and I would simply say again, proof of risk of loss was an element treated by Judge Rodriguez as such, and the only evidence in the record on that subject is not anything we've said here today or that the lawyer said before Judge Rodriguez. It's in Ms. Valdez's testimony, and the sum and substance of her testimony is there's no risk here other than the risk that's always present, even with a good check.
All right, Mr. Calso, you're court-appointed, and as with many in your stead, the court has a tremendous amount of appreciation for your work in taking up the case, particularly on appeal, and briefing it and coming to argue. We thank you for your services.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Gay.